Brothers and sisters, our brother Mark Vincent of Boston, Massachusetts, is leading our second class. His theme for the week, suffering, man's problem, God's problem. And our topic for today is the question of Job. Brother Mark.
Good morning, brothers and sisters.
Good morning.
We probably need six sessions to talk about Job, but we have one. So let's do the best we can. In fact, this is the class I was most looking forward to giving. Just hope that I don't mess it up. The book of Job is the book in the Bible that most obviously deals with the question of suffering. And yet, it very obviously does not answer the question that we might expect that it would when God finally speaks towards the end of the book. So the book builds and builds this sense of anticipation, this sense of expectation that at last, when men have done their best and their worst with their reasoning about what the cause of this suffering might be, what the explanation of Job's excruciating pain might be, we're waiting for that moment when God will finally tell us what the answer is, what the why was, what the reason is. And God singularly fails or refuses to do that. And that's the great paradox of the book of Job, isn't it? And in that paradox, we must find meaning. And it's in fact part of a big theme that goes through the book, I think. It's not just that we're building and building to this point where God finally speaks and God fails to tell us why Job suffers. Everything about the book of Job is built around us not knowing why he's suffering. That's the key to the book, in a way that we don't know. That suffering does not come with a label on it that explains why it has come. And in the absence of that label, we have to live with it and to do what we must during it and after it, to maintain our faith in God and to grow in Him. So what I'd like us to do here is to think about some possible explanations as to why Job suffers, and then to look how each one of those explanations breaks down. And the book deliberately breaks it down and refuses to allow that to be an explanation. Now, many of the points that we'll look at in this chart, so the list of possible explanations is on the left of that slide. Many of these explanations have truth in them, but they are not the full truth. They're not the complete truth. They're not the answer. We can't latch onto any one of these points and say, aha, I've got this point, I now know why Job suffered. And therefore, if I look at my own suffering, if only I just pore over it enough, there will be a moment where suddenly I'll be able to say, aha, and latch onto it and say, I now know why I suffered. The best that will be is an interpretation, isn't it? Our interpretation of why we suffered or are suffering. And so it would be with Job. But what the book of Job does is it deliberately, literary scholars call this deconstructing. It deliberately deconstructs any theories that we might come up with as to why Job suffered. And for me, that's part of the magic, the wonder of the book. This is what makes Job such a brilliant treatment of the problem of suffering. So let's just stay on the surface level of the book for a second and say, well, Job suffers because Satan had a different view to God and made this kind of a wager of, does Job fear God for naught? So perhaps Job suffers just because the Satan sets up this notion, and we have to find out whether or not that's true. And you might say, well, what do you think about Satan? And the answer is, I try not to. So we don't need to get into what does the Satan represent, because that will be an act of interpretation, because the book, again, does not tell us, does it? The book does not tell us who or what the Satan is. The Satan is there just as the Satan. And the Satan sets up this problem and Job suffers as a consequence. But if we thought that that were the explanation, you know, suppose we believed for a second, just imagine that we believed in the supernatural type of Satan, which doesn't make any sense in the book of Job, but let's just imagine that we did believe in the sort of the church's conception of Satan. Well, the book deconstructs that conclusion, because what we'd expect the book to do then is, having proved Satan wrong, wouldn't we bring Satan back on stage and say, look, Satan, you were wrong, weren't you? You got it wrong. And Satan then would be punished or some such thing. But the Satan just completely disappears. The Satan disappears from the book of Job. So if we thought the reason for Job's suffering was really something to do with Satan, that he was the ultimate cause of the suffering, then the book deconstructs that by making him evaporate. He vanishes, he disappears. There is no explanation itself in the character of Satan, because he's just removed from the story. So, does Job suffer because he was a sinner? Because he had something to learn, something was not right in his understanding? Is that the basis for his suffering, because he was a sinner? Well, the very first verse of the book tells us, no, that he was righteous. He was perfect and upright, wasn't he? And of course, we know that means he wasn't absolutely perfect like the Lord Jesus Christ. But as far as human beings who are not the Lord Jesus Christ are concerned, he was an extremely righteous man. The greatest of the children of the East, not only in his wealth, but also in terms of his spirituality. So the very point about him suffering is that he wasn't a sinner relative to other men, and so that can't be the explanation. It can't be the full explanation. I agree fully that Job did certainly have things to learn and something to be repented of, but the reason why he suffered cannot be comprehended fully in the statement he was a sinner, because the whole thing is based around the fact that he was a perfect man. Well, so then let's flip that over then and say, well, perhaps Job suffered because he wasn't a sinner. But at the end of the book, he repents. So he must have been a sinner. Do you see the point about how it deconstructs itself? The book won't let you attach onto any one of these things and make that the sole explanation for the suffering of Job. There is no sole explanation that we are given for his suffering. Does Job suffer to break the retribution equation? So the retribution equation is like what we were talking about in Proverbs yesterday. If you're good, then you'll get good things, and if you're bad, then God's going to punish you and you'll have a bad harvest and so forth. Does Job suffer to prove that that's not the case, that that's not a universal rule? Well, that seems quite hopeful, doesn't it? And that is one of the things that the book of Job demonstrates. But then the book even deconstructs that conclusion, because when Job repents at the end and is right before God at the end of the book, then God gives him twice as much as he had before and reestablishes the retribution equation. So just when you think that the book has said the retribution equation is completely wrong, God then does something which says, yeah, well, it might not be as completely wrong as you thought it was. So we're left again in the state of not being able to say with any certainty why it was that Job suffered. Does Job suffer to show that God is not obliged to answer? God certainly doesn't directly answer why question, and yet he does answer, doesn't he? He doesn't answer, and yet he does answer at the same time. He answers in the form of questions, as we're going to look at in a moment. Does Job suffer to teach him something, to save his friends, to make him a type of Christ? Well, there's truth in all of those. His suffering does achieve all of those things, but is any one of them a sufficient explanation and a complete explanation for his suffering? Well, the book does not give us a license to say so. We may think that, but that's what it will be, our thought and our interpretation. Does Job suffer to show that suffering is beyond explanation and rationalization? But the book contains clues that encourage rationalization. So the book deconstructs itself then in that sense, and we end up having come up with all these theories of, well, I think Job suffered for this reason or for this reason or for this reason, and we find that, yes, there is truth in every one of those. Job was a wonderful type of Christ. Job was an innocent sufferer, and yet at the same time, suffering brought out a sinful attitude that he had and enabled him to correct it. There's truth in all of them, but none of them is a sufficient or complete truth. So we cannot then say in a nutshell why it was that Job suffered. And as I say, I think this is the genius of the book, in that it moves the question from the question that we want to ask. This is the first question that we want to ask, isn't it? We want to ask, why did he suffer? And the book refuses to allow us to answer that question and moves us to a different question. So let's, we're of course moving towards the speeches of God, and we want to find out what God has got to say. But before we get there, let's just think how Job ends his speeches. And this is, his final speech is a long one of five or so chapters, if I remember rightly. And the very last chapter of it is chapter 31. And five chapters, 26 to 31. And what Job does in those chapters is to protest his innocence. And we've arrived at a situation in these chapters where Job's primary concern now is with himself and his innocence. And we can see here something of a problem then, can't we? Because our primary concern in life should not be with ourselves. It should be with God. And Job, of course, has said many wonderful and true things about God in his speeches. But now as he draws to a conclusion, his preoccupation is more and more with himself and his innocence and less with God, particularly in this final chapter. And so he talks in verse 35 and 36 of chapter 1, verses that are pretty tricky to translate. Let's just look at those in the AV. Oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me, and that mine adversary had written a book. Surely I would take it on my shoulder and bind it as a crown to him. I would declare unto him the number of my steps. As a prince would I go near unto him. And the NIV puts that as the idea of, you know, he's written down this account of his innocence. I sign now my defense, the NIV puts it. And I think that's a good way of understanding, you know, the essence of what's going on in this passage. I wish that the Lord would make known his indictment of me. What is it that the Lord has against me? And I sign my defense now that I am innocent. And I would take that defense, and I would take the indictment of the Lord. If he had written a book that said what I'd done wrong, then I would be proud to wear it. And I would carry it, I would bear it on my shoulder. I would put it on my forehead. I would wear it like a crown. Job wants to wear his innocence like a crown now and approach God as a prince. And it's obvious that something has gone wrong here, isn't it? Because none of us are entitled to approach God like a prince with our own righteousness bound upon us. Even though it's true that Job was, relatively speaking, a righteous man, we remember again the words of the Lord Jesus Christ. Why callest thou me good? And if he could say that, then Job had not attained to his standard. And finally, Job says, if I have eaten the fruits thereof, verse 39, if I have eaten the fruits thereof without money, or have caused the owners thereof to lose their life, let thistles grow instead of wheat and cockle instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. So what's all this about thistles and cockle then? Well, the whole chapter is based on a series of if-then statements where Job is saying, if I've done this bad thing, and if I've done this bad thing, or if I've done this bad thing, and the point is, of course, he hasn't done any of those things. You know, if I have looked upon a maid in an inappropriate way, if I've done this, if I've taken my neighbor's goods, or, you know, said bad things about another person, if I've done any of those things, and he surveys all these bad things that he might have done, and knowing that he hasn't done them, and he says, if I've done any of those things, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and cockle instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. And he means then nothing means anything. Then white is black and black is white. I haven't done any of those things. And that's where he concludes his speeches. That's finally what he's got to say for himself, that he is an innocent sufferer. And then Elihu speaks. And then God speaks. So let's have a look at the start of God's speeches in chapter 38. And what God's speeches are about are transferring the topic of debate. Because the topic of debate is not Job, as far as God is concerned. The topic of debate is himself. And God moves the conversation from a conversation about Job and his relative innocence or lack of it. That's not the point. It's not about him. It's about God and about God's purpose and about whether or not God knows what he's doing in the world and he's able to do the right thing. Job's innocence or lack of it is irrelevant in that sense. So Job's got the subject wrong as he winds his speech down to a conclusion. And of course, in suffering, this is what will naturally tend to happen, that we can focus in on ourselves, and it becomes about us, and why is this happening to me? And that's exactly where Job is. His final speech is all about him. And God says that it's not about you, Job, it's about God, and about whether our conception of God is right. It's not about our conception of ourselves, it's about our conception of God. God does not exist for man's sake, and man does not exist for his own sake. Everything is about God, and God refuses to talk about anything else in his speeches apart from the greatness of his works. So we need to think about why God would do that and what the implications of it would be. Let's have a look in chapter 38 then, and verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge?" And he's speaking there very clearly, I think we can demonstrate. He's speaking there to Job. He's not speaking to Elihu. "Gird up thou thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me." And I think there's heavy irony as God says this to Job. "Gird up now thy loins like a man." You know, if you think you can take me on, if you think that we can meet in court and have a debate about something, well, you better get your loins girded and prepare yourself then, because you don't know what you've asked for. As if it will make any difference, as God now comes and speaks to Job, whether Job's loins are girded or not. The mocking of that when he says, "Gird up now thy loins like a man," like a real tough man, when he speaks to the Almighty God. "For I will demand of thee, and answer thou me." It's not about your questions, Job. These are the questions that I have for you that you should think about, is implicitly what God is saying there. "Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding." And then, of course, we go into a series of questions. Verse 5, "Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened?" So we go into a whole series of questions now about the creation and about what Job knows about it, which is virtually nothing, and about the sustaining of the world, and if what Job knows about that, and whether he's able to accomplish any of it by himself. And the answer is no, he's not. And then we go into questions about the animals and what Job knows about them. And the answer is not very much. And then we go into even more strange territory as we talk about Behemoth and Leviathan. And here's a quick count. You may get slightly different numbers. We did this quickly, but this just gives a sense of the bombardment as God bombards Job with these questions. 33 questions about creating and sustaining the world. 23 questions about the animals, 16 questions about Behemoth and Leviathan, making more than 70 questions in total. God gives no answer. He only gives all these questions. And none of these questions is about suffering. They're all about God and whether Job is any match for God and whether Job has any idea what God is up to in all these 72 different areas. And the answer is no. And so when God asks Job about the animals, he doesn't pick the animals that Job knows about. He picks weird and wonderful animals, some of which Job may not even know existed. So he doesn't ask him about sheep. Job has 7,000 sheep. Job knows plenty about sheep. So he asks him about some other animal that about which Job knows nothing. And I'm sure we've all been in the situation of having watched nature programs and you see these bizarre creatures. You think, what on earth is that about? Why would you have one of them? What would God design that for? And the answer is, no idea. It's utterly beyond us, isn't it? And God is like this incredible artist operating at some level which is so far above the level that we wouldn't even have begun to imagine something like that. And they're still discovering them, aren't they? You know, there's that enormous trench, and we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about what's in that trench, and we've been like a third of the way down it or something, haven't we? One of those deep sea trenches. And new species are still being discovered. And even as we answer questions, more doors of further questions are opened up to us. So God's argument here in these questions is still relevant today. Though we've written books and books and papers, and though the internet is stuffed with knowledge about all kinds of stuff, the extent of our ignorance is growing at least as fast as the extent of what we know. So when we look around at the world and at the creation which God has sustained and which God has designed, and when we learn just a few facts about a few random examples of those creatures and see how amazing they are, then we come back to that question. So does God know what he's doing? Can God be trusted to run the world? Does he owe an explanation? If he is capable of doing all that and apparently doing it rather well, and he's given us no explanation for any of those things, he doesn't give an explanation for all his creatures, does he, and explain to us why he created it? It's just a tiny fraction of the wonders of his ways. So why should we expect that he would give us an explanation for our suffering, or that we would understand it if he did? And so God's questions, which he bombards Job with, are in fact an answer, because they transfer the sphere of debate and because they correct our sense of proportion and our sense of who God is. And if our sense of who God is can grow, then our sense of who we are and what is going on in our lives can be transformed as well. So here's the principle. Let God be God. He's rather good at it. It's not our responsibility to explain what God is doing in our lives. We can leave it to him. If we can trust him to make and sustain this great world with its infinite diversity and beauty and wonder, then we can trust him to work in our lives, knowing that his angel encamps around those who fear him, knowing that his eyes are always upon us. It's not our responsibility to explain what God is doing in our lives. We don't have to decide what the cause is of what happens to us. But if we can see within it the potential for us to change and to grow, as Job came to see, then we should take that opportunity that God's giving us. Even though Job was a perfect man and an upright, one who feared God and eschewed evil, yet there was more for him to learn about the greatness of his God and the wisdom of his God in God's involvement in Job's life. So Job too, who was a perfect man, was made perfect through sufferings, wasn't he? He was made more perfect than he already was because of those things that he suffered. So let's take a couple of quotes then that sort of pull together some of these themes that we've been thinking about Job's suffering. From this flows the basic conclusion at which the poet has arrived. Just as there is order and harmony in the natural world, though imperfectly grasped by man, so there is order and meaning in the moral sphere, though often incomprehensible to man. So when we can't understand what God is doing in our lives, we can think about some of the remarkable, bizarre, strange things that there are in the natural world and ask ourselves whether the hand of God is to be seen there and whether it's the same God that is working in one sphere as in the other, and ask ourselves which sphere is actually more important to God. And the answer is the sphere of our lives, because we're in a covenant relationship to him. God doesn't explain at the end of the book of Job, this guy says. He explodes. He asks Job who he thinks he is anyway. He says that to try to explain the kind of things Job wants explained would be like trying to explain Einstein to a little neck clown. God doesn't reveal his grand design. He reveals himself. And if suffering is a way for us to see God more perfectly, then there would be value in it for us, as there was for Job. And so C.S. Lewis now, in this book, A Grief Observed, which I'll talk about in a second, he brings this back to ourselves now and our own trials and tribulations and the questions that we have about things that happen in our lives. When I lay these questions before God, I get no answer, but a rather special sort of no answer. It is not the locked door. It is more like a silent, certainly not uncompassionate, gaze, as though he shook his head, not in refusal, but waving the question like, "Peace, child, you don't understand." Can a mortal ask questions which God finds unanswerable? Quite easily, I should think. All nonsense questions are unanswerable. How many hours are there in a mile? Is yellow square or round? Probably half the questions we ask, half our great theological and metaphysical problems, are like that. It's quite an interesting idea, isn't it? You know, we live under this perception that we're so smart and deep in our thinking, and yet, you know, we're probably so shallow in comparison to what God is doing behind the scenes, under the surface. So we must learn to let him be God, the great God that he is. So let's think about Job as an example then in suffering. Job speaks out vehemently about what he feels, and it's right that he should do that. It's right for us to tell God what we feel. How do we know that it's right? Well, we know it because the book of Job is there for us. And because Job came through that experience and grew spiritually and was blessed by God for what he endured. We know it because the Psalms are full of psalms of lament, in which the psalmist tells in no uncertain terms the anguish that he feels, the questions that he has of God. He states the fact that he can't understand, he can't begin to fathom why God is behaving as he is, why God is silent, why God doesn't say something or do something. It seems so obvious to the psalmist that God could have done things in such a better way, and yet God hasn't. and the psalmist comes before God and tells him this. Why have you cast me off? Why have you rejected me? Why do you hide your face from me? Why don't you say something? These are the things that the psalmist says in psalm after psalm. There are more psalms of that type, more lament psalms about problems in which the heart is poured forth before God. There are more psalms of that type than any other type of psalms. Far more psalms of that type than there are psalms of praise. Why are they in the Bible? Why are they inspired by God and kept by his providence to be in the Bible? Because God is showing us that we can speak to him like this. And if we feel that way, when we should not lock it away and pretend it isn't, we should tell him how we feel. And the book of Job does that. Jeremiah the prophet does that. The book of Lamentations does that. The book of Psalms does it. But what they also do, and this is interesting, they also express the faith that they have. That they believe that one day salvation will come. And it's important to do that too. There are only, out of the whole book of Psalms, there are only about two psalms which are sort of the exception that proves the rule in a way, that don't do that, that don't express both doubt and faith at the same time. There are only about two psalms that just express doubt. All of the rest, they express the doubt, the anger, the frustration, the tears, the questions, and also at the same time, they express the faith that still remains. I mean, if there were no faith left, then, of course, there wouldn't be even any point in speaking to God because we wouldn't even believe that he was there listening. So if we have some faith, even if it's only a tiny strand of faith left and all this doubt, we should communicate that doubt to God, and we should also communicate the small bit of faith that we have. That's what the Psalms do again and again. And then leave things in God's care. And try to take on board the lesson that Job was taught through the questions of God about his wonderful control and great purpose. So it's right to speak out, to be honest, to express all those emotions. The Bible shows us that very clearly. It's a very important point. And there's also a time to stop speaking and to listen, isn't there? And that's what Job did. Let's go back into Job and Job's response to God in chapter 40. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, "Shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproveth God, let him answer it." Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once have I spoken, but I will not answer. Yea, twice, but I will proceed no further." And so the Lord answers Job the second time and drives the points home that he's already been making and says again to Job, "Gird up now thy loins like a man," in verse 7. "I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me. Wilt thou also disannul my judgment? Wilt thou condemn me that thou mayest be righteous?" Remember again, who is this about? Is it about you or is it about God? Everything is about God. He is the center. He is the cause. He is the origin. He is the goal. It's all about him. So we must strive not to make the mistake that Job made here of disannulling God's judgment, of condemning him, that we may be righteous. And so Job speaks in chapter 42. And verse 2, "I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge?" says Job, quoting now God's own words back to him. "Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, things too wonderful for me, which I knew not." And Job now recognizes that he was the one who darkened counsel by words without knowledge. He recognizes his own responsibility, his own attitudes that needed to be changed. "He uttered things too wonderful for him which he did not understand. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And though Job had expressed so much anger and frustration against God in his speeches, that was okay. God was big enough and merciful enough to forgive him all those things that he said, because he also spoke true things about God. And now Job is brought to this point where he sees how the hand of God has worked in his life and how God has developed him. And so he says, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And now he's at that point, then God brings the blessings back upon him. And so we see Job's patience and his grit, and James picks up that, doesn't he, in his letter, and says, you've heard of the patience of Job. We need that too. We need it to survive, to hang on, that grim determination that we will not abandon our faith in the God who made us. And we learn too from Job's example that it's right to pray for and to help one's friends. And that's what he does. His suffering brought him to a position where he was able to pray for them, and where not only he was developed spiritually, but his friends, who were mistaken, were developed too. And so he's able to help them and to save them, just as Christ, who suffered, was able to save his friends, even ourselves. And maybe a little word or two about the friends and their unhelpful help. And Job said to them, didn't he, miserable comforters are ye all. And just going back for a second to Philip Yancey's book, he has a number of good quotes about how unhelpful people can be when in the presence of someone who is suffering. And one person, I think it was one person who had suffered a lot, said, the most miserable part of the whole experience was my Christian friends. And, you know, isn't it a shame that they had to admit that? The time to get the intellectual foundation, the theoretical foundation for these things, is before the suffering starts, isn't it? And then when suffering comes, attempts by others to explain or to point out things that we might have been doing wrong are not helpful then in those times. And I'm just quoting the wisdom of other people now and assuming that to be the case. And what's needed then is consistency. Someone to just be there, to hold a hand, to sit there, to say nothing, but just to be there and to show solidarity, to show concern, to mourn with them in their suffering and in their difficulty. The kind of experience that Job went through, the anger and the frustration that he poured out that we see again in the Psalms and in the prophets that I've already spoken of, that's not something that doesn't happen anymore by any means. And that book from C.S. Lewis that I quoted, I want to just talk to you about that for a couple of minutes, a book called A Grief Observed. So when he was a younger man, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Problem of Pain, and most of the C.S. Lewis quotes so far have been from The Problem of Pain. And that was the sort of the theoretical foundation for thinking about suffering. And then he suffered. He married relatively late in life, about, I think, in his late 50s or possibly his 60s, I'm not sure exactly. And you know, he thought he was never going to get married, he was never going to meet someone, and then he did. And then in a few short years, she was dead of cancer, and God took her away. And he felt that anguish, that anger, that pain. And one of the things he says there was that the problem was not stopping to believe in God, but starting to believe such terrible things about him, that God would seem to give this wonderful gift only to snatch it away, and the pain that brought about in his heart. And now he was having to do pain rather than talk about pain, as he'd done in his earlier book. Now he was having to experience a level of intensity of suffering and loss and grief. And so the book, the short book, A Grief Observed, is him writing down what he felt. And he goes through an experience just like Job, where he's completely unable to understand what's going on, understand how God could possibly be working for good in this. All these doubts about God and the nature of God are poured out. And it's fascinating to watch him going through that experience and that sense of her presence, his wife's presence, and yet obviously her absence at the same time. And then as he works through those four chapters, he starts to be able to put his life together again and to put his thoughts about God into a new and actually deeper perspective than they were before. And it certainly is a fascinating book to read. I want to conclude, though, with another principle. Consequences count. When we suffer, the stakes are raised. And we could have another principle for that, I suppose, called the suffering raises the stakes principle. And it does, doesn't it? Think about Job. So Job was just going along happily in life and all things were good, and he was a spiritual man, and he also was a material man in the sense that he had lots of material things. Times were good for Job, and then he suffered. And now, suddenly, there is a potential. There is the potential that he should curse God and die, as his wife encouraged. Now, he would never have cursed God and died before he suffered, would he? He would have no reason to. Things were going well. And the suffering brings that potential. The stakes are raised because now the stakes are raised for Job to go off in the wrong direction. But the stakes are raised for good too. Job would have never learned about the need to let go of his own righteousness. He would have never learned to think about the wonders of God in nature and what that implies about God's ability to be in control and to do the right thing in our own lives. Unless he'd been through this experience. He would never have been able to pray for his friends and save them as he did if he'd not been through it. The stakes are raised because of his suffering. They're raised with the potential as free will always gives you, the potential for bad and the potential for good. Suffering raises the potential of what we can achieve, spiritually speaking. It raises the potential for evil. That's the risk, the curse God and die risk. And again, God is prepared to allow that potential of free will in order that we might choose the good rather than the evil and grow as Job grew. Think of some of the consequences. Now Job's eye sees his maker. His three friends have brought salvation. Job's attitude is changed. Their attitude is changed. Job is cleansed from his secret sins, this thing of wanting to cling on to his own righteousness. He's made perfect through sufferings, even though he was perfect already. Here's our final quotation from Brother Andrew Perry. Job's reaction is to declare, "I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know." This conclusion to the book may suggest that the only adequate approach to the problem of human suffering is a pastoral one in which the sufferer is brought to experience the presence of God in his suffering. So the point of suffering is not to explain it. The point of the book of Job is not that we should study it to answer the question, why did Job suffer? Because the book deliberately refuses to allow us to answer that question. Instead, we ask the question, how do we suffer? And what difference will it make? And what and how will our understanding of God and our closeness to Him and our knowledge of Him, how will that change as the result of all the experiences of our lives, both good and bad? For me, one of the most powerful verses of the book is chapter 42 and verse 5. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear. That's a theoretical bit, isn't it? That's the first book that C.S. Lewis wrote. That's all the knowledge, the theoretical foundation. But the practical aspect of the things that he went through in his life enabled him to say these words, "But now mine eye seeth thee."